Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Amundson against Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Mr. Pletel.
Good morning. I am Robert Thine Pletel. We represent the plaintiffs who are members of the Wisconsin Family Care Program. They're already in the program. The proposed class members are already in the program. We're not seeking any changes to the program itself. We're not seeking to change the basket of services that an eligible member receives. The essence of the case is that a certain service, that is residential services, which is actually another smaller basket of services, is not being parceled out equally to all of the members of the program, and particularly that those cuts are being focused at people with developmental disabilities. Now, the case presents the court with a series of options. The Rehabilitation Act claims are not subject to the 11th Amendment defense. If the Rehabilitation Act claims are all valid, then it doesn't matter whether Title III applies to CARE Wisconsin, because CARE Wisconsin is also a Rehabilitation Act entity. So let's talk about the types of discrimination first. The complaint alleges that the other disability groups are getting everything they need. They're getting all the residential services they need to stay out of institutions. The complaint further alleges that a particular group is not receiving those services. Now, that's not a differential treatment argument. That's an integration argument. And all that's necessary for an integration argument is to say, these are the services that the state is obligated to provide in a particular program. Those are being cut not in a reasonable way that's based on individualized needs, but rather in an ad hoc, in an across-the-board fashion, and therefore it creates a risk of institutionalization. And we believe that Judge Crabb set the bar too high by saying they had to show imminent harm. They would, in fact, have to suffer the harm that we're trying to prevent in order to state a case under that theory. We are alleging that moving people and allowing them to deteriorate and then moving them some more is disruptive and will ultimately lead to them being placed in institutions. And by the way, we're talking about institutions, but the integration provision also covers any less integrated setting. And so we've also alleged that the services they're receiving are being cut within the home, and the result is they're going out into the community less, they're being taken to see their families less. All of the things that other members of the program are getting are being restricted for people with developmental disabilities. The defendants are arguing that a whole series of regulations make it implausible that our plaintiffs will be going into institutions, and obviously this is a case that was dismissed on the pleadings. So we have alleged that all of those very fine policies and procedures that are being applied to the other disability groups are not being provided to the developmental disabilities group, and that's the essence of our claim. There's a particular argument that all that will happen is that the plaintiffs, if they move from their current homes, will go to just another home with equal services. And we believe we've supplied specific allegations with regard to a number of the plaintiffs that show, first of all, how difficult it was to arrange proper services, how in some cases it took years and a series of different homes to tailor those services, and that it's certainly reasonable to infer that if we disrupt those carefully designed services, they will deteriorate. And remember, this is a putative class action, so it's not that every one of the plaintiffs or every one of the class will ultimately end up in an institution. It is that they are significantly more likely to face institutionalization, and that's the essence of the claim. The plaintiffs, the choices that they made to live where they are living, the choices that they and their guardians made, were not based on a whim. They were specifically tailored, very specialized, and it's reasonable to infer, first of all, it's just not possible to reproduce that for many of these individuals. And second, if they do go to other homes, those homes will face the same sorts of rate issues which have caused all of the developmental disabilities providers to have to cut services, cut staff, and those are the things that cause the substantial risk of institutionalization. So just saying they'll be able to move to other homes isn't sufficient. They are safe. They are pleased with the services they are receiving. It's like they're in a lifeboat, many of them, after some serious concerns and issues in their lives. And the defendants are saying, you can jump back in the water, but don't worry, we'll have another lifeboat for you. We think that creates a substantial risk. And as I said, I think that Judge Crabb just set the bar too high by asking for proof of allegations of imminent placement in a less integrated setting.
So if a state administration believes that the services are being provided at too high a cost, that they want to try to squeeze out unnecessary expenditures in the program, under your theory, how could they go about that?
They could do an assessment of whether the individual clients could be served more inexpensively. And actually, they have done that over the years in many situations. We've alleged that either counties or managed care organizations have come to residential providers and said, it seems inefficient to have two people living in this house and two people living in another house. So can we combine those? Can we do other services?
Is that unlawful?
That's not unlawful.
Why not? It seems to pose the same kinds of risks of transfer trauma that you're alleging here.
If it's done in a planful way, and if there are sufficient services when we're all done with those adjustments, then there's no problem under either the integration theory or our disparate treatment and impact theory.
And how does a judge tell the difference between what's lawful and unlawful there?
I think that the best way to look at this is that at a certain point in time, the family care system statewide was operating reasonably well. And that is, not everyone got what they wanted, and occasionally people had to move for various reasons, including they didn't work out with their roommates or something, to move closer to a family member. And though that level of churn in the system did not impact the ability of providers to stay in business and to serve people properly, these rate cuts have had a terrible effect. They are just a huge level of churn, statewide, hundreds of notices of discharge that residential providers gave just people with developmental disabilities. And so it's what we'll be looking at as we prove this is just what's an acceptable level of churn based on developmental disabilities professionals, and are people receiving proper services according to disability professionals?
Okay. I'm frankly struggling with how that is a judicially administrable standard. It sounds like defer to the experts who are not the state experts working for the people who are paying the bills.
Well, I think it's possible that we could rely on the state experts. What we have alleged is not that the state said cut rates to people with developmental disabilities. What we're alleging is that the individual managed care organizations decided to target people with developmental disabilities and specifically residential services, and that the state both approved it and didn't do anything to stop it. That's the state's job here, and I think the state probably has people who could conduct that type of assessment, and our complaint with the state is that they didn't do that. And, Your Honor, I'll just say the all of the rate cut and service cut issues across the nation have involved situations where there's a system running reasonably well, and then there are cuts, and what we do is we ask disability professionals what's happened. And if they say, we've now reduced services to an unacceptable level and these various harms are going to result, well, that's how we make the case. And we'd like an opportunity to do that, obviously, through discovery. I'd like to change, if I could, over to the actual discrimination between groups aspect of the case. And obviously, the case that everyone has talked about is Grosan. And our point is that, first of all, Grosan is a Rehabilitation Act case. It did not discuss the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it was one of a number of cases involving medical treatment, both of infants and other people, and their disguised malpractice cases or disguised state law claims trying to come in under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I think the courts very properly had to develop some limiting principles, and Grosan was this court's way of doing that. If we look at the Americans with Disabilities Act, the regulations, our textual analysis goes into detail about how otherwise was just taken out of the qualified definition in the 70s. Congress knew that. Congress passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA regulations don't contain the word otherwise. And so therefore, the real Grosan just didn't have all the pieces of the puzzle before it, and this court does. And cases across the country have held that people within a disability program can challenge discrimination in that program. And another thing we've cited to the court is regulation. It's in all of, it's in the ADA, it's in the Rehabilitation Act, it's in Title III of the ADA, 28 CFR 4151B14, and that's the regulation that says that it's prohibited discrimination to provide different or separate aid, benefits, or services to handicapped persons or to any class of handicapped persons. And I'm leaving out the rest of that paragraph. But the courts that have looked at that regulation have said, obviously, within group discrimination can be a cause of action under the ADA.
Right. And I understand your argument about how Olmstead certainly seems to call into question at least some of the language in Grosan and Mallett. With these regulations that say you cannot discriminate on the basis, in essence, of severity of disabilities, what I'm struggling with, Mr. Pletel, is, as I understand this, you would insist that there be some differential treatment. For example, somebody who needs line-of-sight care is going to be a lot more expensive to take care of than somebody who doesn't, right?
That's correct.
And your position would be that the law requires differential funding there?
At two levels, Your Honor. First of all, that's the way the program works. If I'm a disabled person in the program
If the state decided to switch to just a flat rate, I assume there would be good reason to challenge that.
If the state went to a flat rate, I think it would be an integration issue if certain people could show this isn't enough for us to stay in the community. But I think the differential treatment issue would go away. This is not a situation where the legislature said we need to cut costs across the board, and then family care headquarters said we're cutting physically disabled, developmentally disabled, all the same amount.
Well,
let's switch targeting.
Okay, let's switch from money to services. This person's getting line-of-sight care. Staff are awake 24/7. This other person does not get that degree of attention. that's differential treatment, right?
That's acceptable differential treatment because we do trust the procedures within family care that decide what people get.
Okay.
What we don't trust is this behind-the-scenes decision to just... What residential services have been targeted. It's in their business plans. They talk about it at public gatherings. They say we're out after residential services and residential providers.
I understand that. But how does a judge, if we send this back to Judge Crabb, how does she tell the difference between lawful differences in treatment and care and benefits and services and aids and unlawful discrimination under this regulation?
Experts could look at a given set of facts and say that's not a sufficient plan. But what I would say is that we actually have data from people whose services have been cut, and we can look at things like have they been hospitalized for medical conditions, for psychiatric conditions, or whatever. And so there's going to be evidence.
I understand. Okay. I understand there will be evidence of some bad effects. What legal standard should we instruct, under your theory, Judge Crabb, to apply that will help a district judge differentiate between permissible, benign, differential treatment and unlawful discrimination under these regulations?
The family care program itself promises everyone health, community integration, I get to decide where I live. If Judge Crabb looks at what's available to those other two disability groups and looks at are people with developmental disabilities as a group being provided with less services than that they're entitled
like
to.
Legal standard. That sounds like you're asking the district judge to be the administrator of the program and make what amounts to an administrative decision. I have the same concern as Judge Hamilton. Can you articulate a legal standard that the judicial branch is supposed to apply?
The cases that I'm familiar with look at outcomes.
Don't worry about cases.
Okay.
Just tell me what, in your view, is the legal standard that the judicial branch should apply. We'll put this in an opinion and tell the district judge to do that. So what is that?
Are people with developmental disabilities having significantly worse outcomes in a number of bullet points compared to comparable people who are frail elderly and who have the other disabilities?
I don't understand what that means. Significantly worse outcomes. I don't know what significant means. I don't know what worse means. It sounds, as I say, it sounds like an administrative rule rather than a judicial one. Now, maybe what you really wish is that the administrators, the people in the federal government who are behind all of this, would write down a regulation like that, but you don't seem to be relying on one.
I think the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehab Act work here, Judge, and the issue is, let me use this example. If I'm a person with developmental disabilities, and because of all of these rate cuts, I have fewer residential providers to choose from, and when I go to each one of those residential providers and ask, can you provide all the cares I need, they say, no, we can't because the rate isn't high enough. But
I completely lose you when you say things like all the care I need. It's a basic principle of economics that everybody says he needs everything in the world.
And I want to repeat what I said to Judge Hamilton, and that is we trust the process within family care that determines rates.
You may say, I represent the plaintiffs. I represent the people who say they have needs. And therefore, we trust the people who will verify the size of their needs. But you have to understand that the people who are paying the bill don't trust them. The people who are paying the bill are skeptical about them. That's what this is about. Your claim is essentially to an unlimited subsidy based on whatever my people can justify.
Well, that
and
gets us...
You might find the taxpayers are restive.
That gets to the fundamental alteration defense, Your Honor. What the state is saying is if it involves money at all, the 11th Amendment says we don't have to do it. And what I'm saying is Olmstead in every similar case says if the state has a legitimate financial defense, the court judges that, And courts across the nation have looked at fundamental alteration defenses. A fundamental alteration defense is supposed to be a part of the weighing process. It's not a trump card, and I'm afraid that's what the 11th Amendment argument that the state is making has elevated it to. And my time is up. Thank you very much, counsel.
Mr. Welch.
May it please the Court. Actually, Chief Justice, my name is Clay Kosky, and we've changed the order.
No Chief Justice is here.
Excuse me, Chief Judge Easterbrook. My name is Clay Kosky, and I'm appearing on behalf of the state defendants, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and its secretary. I have 2 points that I'd like to discuss today. The first is that the Title II ADA claims against the state are barred by sovereign immunity, and that the district court correctly held that under this court's decisions in Council 31 and MSA Realty Corporation, that the ex parte Young exception to sovereign immunity does not apply. The plaintiffs have requested that the rates paid to...
Say, I don't even understand this sovereign immunity argument. The plaintiffs are asking for entirely prospective relief.
Chief Judge, in this Court's decisions in Council 31 and MSA Realty Corp., the Court focused on prospective relief. And they said that you must look beyond, this Court said, that you must look to whether the plaintiff's request would have an effect upon the state treasury that is not merely ancillary, but is the essence of the relief sought. In this case, it is barred by the 11th Amendment.
What do you think about Bowen against Massachusetts?
I'm not familiar with Bowen versus Massachusetts.
The Supreme Court held in Bowen that there is no sovereign immunity bar to a request for prospective relief where the prospective relief is just comply with a federal statute that requires the payment of money. You can't have any back payments, but you can require prospectively that a federal statute be implemented, even when it pays money. That, of course, is the normal relief in a Medicaid case. No catch-up payments, but forward payments have to be made. Now, that's the holding of Bowen. Why should we take a different course?
I would argue that this Court has already taken a different course
in
two cases.
Bowen is a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, right? This Court can't take a different course from the Supreme Court of the United States.
Chief Judge, because I'm not familiar with the facts of Bowen,
Let me try coming at this from a slightly different angle. I understand your point when the plaintiffs frame their complaint in terms of we want an injunction to restore rates to where they were as of January 1, 2012. That looks an awful lot like order the state to spend money.
Right.
Okay? That's a problem. But sometimes plaintiffs ask for the wrong relief. Suppose the injunction that were requested said, for just one provision, for example, the secretary must make sure that everybody who needs line-of-sight care in residential treatment gets it. Is that an 11th Amendment problem?
I think that in that case, there could be an 11th Amendment issue.
However, that's what Bowen addresses, and
however,
it says there's not.
However, in this case, we need to focus on what this Court said in Council 31, which is we look to the essence of the relief sought. The essence of the relief sought here, Judge Hamilton, as you point out, is a payment from the state. We look to, and putting different labels, again, this Court said in Council 31 that putting different labels on the relief, for example, if the plaintiffs have requested only declaratory relief, and I think in their brief they've pointed out, well, we could do some different things here. We could just say, let's do declaratory relief, and then the Court can decide what that'll be, and we'll come back and we'll let them proceed. This Court said in Council 31 that you cannot do that, that if you granted declaratory relief, and this is 680 F3rd at 884, declaratory relief should not be awarded where the 11th Amendment bars an award of monetary or injunctive relief. Otherwise, declaratory relief would operate as a means of avoiding the amendment's bar. So selecting different relief, the plaintiffs have really set the stage here by pleading and asking for a payment of money from the state treasury, and that is the essence of the relief. That is
this all came up pretty fast on the pleading. Suppose the plaintiff said, we want an order from the district judge maintaining the level of services available to our class as of January 1st, 2012.
again, I think that we'd have the same problem requiring payment to the providers to meet that level of care as of January 1st, 2012.
So what do you think we should do with the very large number of cases under the Medicare Act and similar statutes that say it's proper to order the state to comply with the federal statute prospectively, even though that requires the payment of money? Do we have to overrule them all?
I don't think you have to overrule them all. I think you need to, Chief Judge, you need to focus on what this Court has already said in Council 31.
I'm going to start by focusing on what the Supreme Court of the United States has said. And the Supreme Court of the United States has said repeatedly that lower courts can enforce the Medicaid Act, for example. It said in Bowen that federal courts can issue injunctions that give plaintiffs their entitlement. This was the language in Bowen against Massachusetts. To the very thing to which the federal statute entitles them, even though that thing is a grant.
I would argue, because I'm, again, not familiar with Bowen, that to say that
not
the plaintiff...
Simply Bowen. It's Supreme Court cases going back to King from 1971. We've been in this now for 42 years.
I would argue, though, that the plaintiffs have not shown that they're entitled to having services at the January 1st, 2012 level.
That's a question on the merits. It has nothing to do with sovereign immunity.
I think it does, though, Chief Judge, because the plaintiffs have specifically requested and brought that into the pleadings by requesting this specific relief. They've set the table, and they've shown that I'm arguing that under Council 31, that the essence of the relief sought is a payment from the state treasury, therefore it is barred by the 11th Amendment. I'd like to also touch on the Gerzan and Mallett arguments, if I may. We argued Gerzan and Mallett, and those cases stand for the proposition that under the Rehabilitation Act, the words otherwise qualified mean something. They mean that the plaintiff must show that in spite of their disability, they receive these benefits. I also think that, Chief Judge Easterbrook, your decision that you authored in Vaughn versus Sullivan can be relevant.
It doesn't matter who wrote a decision of the court. They are decisions of the court.
The decision of the court in Vaughn versus Sullivan, then, is also consistent with Gerzan and Mallett and suggests that the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA can have components which would treat different disabilities differently. The purpose of the ADA and RA, again, Gerzan and Mallett focus on the RA, or Rehabilitation Act, is that to be otherwise qualified, you must allege in your complaint that you receive the benefits benefits were denied to you because you're disabled, whereas someone who is not disabled was receiving that benefit.
Well, let me just ask you this, if I could, with my indulgence of my colleagues, but... It seemed pretty clear that there were five votes in Olmstead for the view that the law recognizes claims for discrimination within a broad umbrella of a protected group, using, for example, age as an example. Under the Age Discrimination Act, an employer violates the law if it discriminates in favor of people who are in their 40s in the protected class at the expense of those who are in their 60s. Same kind of reasoning seemed to be adopted by at least five justices in Olmstead. How do we reconcile that with our language in Gerzan and Mallett?
I think that I have two responses there. First of all, that the Olmstead decision do not purport to overrule prior decisions like Southeastern Community College versus Davis, which Gerzan and Mallett also cited and quoted and relied upon, which in Southeastern Community College versus Davis, the Supreme Court was actually reviewing the otherwise qualified language in the Rehabilitation Act. Another factor to consider with Olmstead is that the Olmstead Court did not interpret the Rehabilitation Act. It was interpreting the language of Title II of the ADA, which does not include the words otherwise qualified. Gerzan and Mallett interpreted the Rehabilitation Act, which includes those words, and that was the basis for its holding, which relied upon cases like Southeastern Community College versus Davis, Traynor versus Turnage, Alexander versus Choate. None of those cases were even addressed by the majority in Olmstead. And so the Olmstead majority...
If I recall correctly, the dissent, though, thought they were in shreds.
Right. The majority did not address them, but the dissent did point out that there was a conflict here. Mm-hmm. So it's peculiar that the majority did not address those cases if the suggestion is that they're having a holding, or five justices on the Supreme Court had a holding that was inconsistent with the statements in Alexander versus Cho, Traynor versus Turnage, and Southeastern Community College versus Davis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Ms. Kosky.
We switched up the order so that the state could speak first, and that didn't get updated, so sorry for the confusion. But may it please the court, I'm Diane Walsh, representing CARE Wisconsin First, a private, nonprofit community organization that serves as a managed care organization under contract with Wisconsin's Medicaid program. CARE Wisconsin promotes independence and quality of life for adults with disabilities and persons who are elderly as part of its core mission. Plaintiff's counsel is attempting to fit a square peg into a round hole. This is a Medicaid provider rate case. If plaintiffs believe they are not receiving all the benefits and services to which they are entitled under family care, they have numerous options to seek redress under state statute, under the administrative rules, and under informal mechanisms created by the Department of Health Services. But making a claim of discrimination in federal court is not a viable option, and the district court properly dismissed the claims. As presented in our brief, CARE Wisconsin's functions are not subject to Title III of the American with Disabilities Act. In the plaintiff's appellate brief, they indicated only they were pursuing their Title III claims against CARE Wisconsin. Then, in its reply brief, it indicated it was advancing Rehabilitation Act claims against CARE Wisconsin as well. Should this court determine that those claims were not waived, I would adopt the arguments presented by my co-defendants to address the rehabilitation claims, but also the argument that I raised in our brief, which discusses that there just was not a discriminatory action taken by CARE Wisconsin in this case. Although plaintiffs state that this case is about intra-class discrimination, by their own pleadings, CARE Wisconsin did not engage in any form of interclass discrimination or discrimination at all. CARE Wisconsin did evaluate the 100 highest residential provider rates and focused on how to reduce those rates. They evaluated the rates paid to those providers compared to similar providers serving similar clients.
Okay, you're the intermediary, right, between the state and the providers.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay. And what we're getting, as I understand it from plaintiffs, in essence, is when you decided to go after and at least examine and probably cut rates for those 100 highest individuals, that was discriminatory in either intent or impact on developmentally disabled folks. Why is that not a viable theory?
Well, one, we didn't look at individuals. We looked at provider rates. So we didn't look at who were the most expensive individuals collectively, which is an aggregate of all of the fees that might be paid on behalf of the individual. We looked specifically at what the provider rates were, so at who the expensive providers are, and then looked at how those rates compared to similar providers serving similar individuals. And it was based on cost, not disability.
Okay, so, that sounds like merits, and it sounds like evidence, right?
Well, by their own pleadings, they recognize that that's what my client, CARE Wisconsin, did. It's in the pleadings. And then I think the difference here, what is lacking, is an allegation that the persons with developmental disabilities are now receiving less services than our elderly clients or fewer benefits than physically disabled people. They're looking only at the reduction of a provider rate. And under the disability law, no one is entitled to have their providers paid a certain rate. They're entitled, if they're entitled to anything that's non-discriminatory, it's services and benefits that are equal. And there's no allegation in the pleading that these plaintiffs are now getting fewer benefits or fewer services than different classes a family care member's.
So if we agree with that reasoning, it sounds like what we're inviting the plaintiffs to do is wait a little bit longer, let these cuts take effect, begin to suffer the consequences, and then bring a new class action or series of class actions challenging the effect of those cuts on the rates, the effect of the cuts on the services that are provided to them.
A key difference in this case compared to many of the other discrimination cases that flow from Medicaid decisions is that there are all types of protections built in to, first, the waiver agreement that the state of Wisconsin has with CMS, second, state statutes, third, state regulations, fourth, the provider contracts. So there are all types of provisions built in that would encourage consumer choice, options for resolving these on a
formal basis. Nevertheless, you're looking for, and the state is looking for, significant cost savings, right?
Yes, but
okay.
But again, I think
and maybe you'll find only waste, fraud, and abuse to cut, but there are few such line items in most budgets, right?
Mm-hmm.
So significant cuts are likely to have at least some effects on services provided, right? That's not unreasonable, is it?
But that's not been a policy directive of the state, of the legislature, or of our client. So, again, we have to operate consistent.
Right. Well,
the
law usually assumes that people intend the foreseeable consequences of their decisions,
mm-hmm.
Whether we foresee them actually or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering if we agree with you how far we advance the ball if we simply say, this will come back next year in a slightly different form.
And I think it's reasonable to wait and see if it does, because, again, then you can see if the protections are in place, the policies are in place, really prevent what is being alleged might possibly happen do happen. I think the pleadings would rely on inference upon inference upon inference, and the managed care organizations would have to ignore their contractual obligations. The state would have to ignore its obligations to the federal government in order for all of those inferences to actually bear out. You know, so I think it's unfair to put the managed care organizations through expensive litigation just on the thin possibility that all of those inferences could actually play out in the way that's envisioned. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Phillips, dare I say?
You are correct. Thank you and good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Phillips. I represent the Northwest Long-Term Care District, better known as Northern Bridges. It's the managed care organization that represents the 11-county region in Northwest Wisconsin. I want to start out by saying what this case is not about, because I think that's critical to this court's analysis. This case is not about the state of Wisconsin implementing a statewide methodology of changing the service levels or benefit package of the plaintiffs. That distinguishes this case significantly from any other case that plaintiffs have cited to this court as being a valid and viable integration claim case. What this case is all about is very clearly set forth in the relief requested in plaintiff's First Amendment complaint. The relief requested is that provider rates be frozen in time as of January 1, 2012. And I think that the court's questioning of plaintiff's counsel at the first instance was very, very informative as it relates to the true motivations of this case and why this case does not fit squarely.
It sounds to me like they're asking for a freeze. It sounds to me like they're asking for an order that the rates be as high as their friends can justify.
I don't know if I can read that into the amended complaint. I know what the amended complaint says.
It may not be in the amended complaint, but it's certainly what Mr. Pledel said.
Well, and I think that that's where the focus of this case...
If we want more money, we're entitled to it.
And I would agree with you, Judge, and I think that's where the focus of this case is off track, frankly. It's off track because this is not about the service needs, the benefit level needs of the plaintiffs. It's all about the money being paid to the providers. And so if we follow the logic of the plaintiffs in this instance, we pay the providers enough money, according to whatever the plaintiffs say or whatever the providers say, then the service needs are going to be met. That's not how family care is designed to operate. Family care is designed to operate so an interdisciplinary team made up of medical professionals, social work professionals, and the clients and their guardians make decisions in the best interest based on outcomes of the plaintiffs. If plaintiffs' request for relief was about outcomes and service levels, then the argument can be made, this is an ADA or a Rehab Act case. It's not. It's about provider rates. And there are all sort of fail-safe mechanisms in place in Wisconsin law that talk about if there is an impact on service levels, if there's an impact on benefit levels.
It's actually surprising to me, maybe I should have asked Mr. Pleitel, but since at bottom this case is about provider rates, one wonders why it's not a case under the Medicaid statute, because this is a Medicaid program benefit.
I think that's a very good point, Judge. I think that also when you...
Mr. Pleitel's reply brief is express that they are not making a Medicaid claim.
That's correct. And to that point, not only is it a Medicaid Act claim, we have a position where we have a grievance procedure and a fair hearing process in state law to address the very issues that plaintiffs complain about here. They have not gone through that process. Obviously, the issue of exhaustion is not before this court, but I will tell you that that really flows into the entire theory of this case as to why it does not fit within the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act.
Are those processes available to somebody before they're discharged or transferred?
I don't have the exact regulations in front of me, but I'll tell you the regulations are set up so that if somebody has a complaint about a change in their service plan, they can raise that complaint to the managed care organization through the grievance process, and they also have a right to go to a fair hearing process, which is independent of the managed care organization, my client. That goes through, and it's subject to ultimately judicial review in that respect. So the exact language of the regulation, again, is not in front of me, but that's essentially what the grievance procedure and the fair hearing process does. And so when we talk about the risk of institutionalization, because plaintiff's counsel made a big point of this in his briefing and also in his oral argument. And to me, when I think about imminence of institutionalization, imminence is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. What's imminent, what's not imminent? And I just would like to focus the court's attention, if I may, on the fact that if we're talking about imminence of institutionalization, that risk is right there because of provider rate cuts, then the plaintiffs are asking this court to ignore the entire body of state law, statutory law, regulatory law, and the contractual provisions that exist between my client and the state of Wisconsin that say that cannot happen. If you look at the regulations contained within Chapter HS-10 of the Wisconsin Administrative Code, it talks very clearly about what that interdisciplinary team has to look at in terms of placing an individual. It talks about most integrated setting. I'm sorry.
We're being told in the pleadings and the arguments, though, that there has been a dramatic increase in, I think Mr. Pleitel said, churn in the system, which would suggest that maybe all those protections aren't working too well yet.
I would submit to the court that I don't think that the amended complaint says that the protections that are there are not being followed. I think what plaintiff's complaint is that the provider rates have either been frozen or cut, and that has led to that churn. And I think that's a logical inference that the plaintiffs are asking this court to ignore the intermediate steps, which talk about the regulatory and contractual framework that requires that interdisciplinary team to take integration into account when it makes the appropriate recommendation on placement within a residential setting. And so, to me, the provider rate issue is completely separate and distinct from the service levels and benefit levels, and it has to be, because provider rates are subject to fluctuation based on market conditions, geography, all sorts of issues. Provider rates may have absolutely nothing to do with the level of care that's being provided. It may or it may not. Ultimately, it's not an issue subject to review under the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.